Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Biz Radio U, pushing knowledge further by spotlighting the best in business.
Hello and welcome, everybody. My name is Adam Wozniak. I'm joined here today with my friends and co-hosts, Darren Parkinson and Alex Stoker. How's it going, guys?
It's going well, you know, just bracing for that hurricane.
Oh boy, yeah, Irma's coming straight through us.
Yeah.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm not ready for the traffic, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really what's going to hit us hard.
Yeah.
Like, we'll get some rain, but the traffic is, I mean, even if the hurricane goes off a little bit, because it's never exactly as they say, but the traffic is going to be exactly as bad as everyone thinks it's going to be.
Yeah. The part that really freaks me out is the hurricane that just hit Texas, and now we have one coming up, and then there's actually another hurricane. It's only a category 3, but right behind on the heels of it. So to me, it's kind of crazy right now.
Oh yeah, you know it's bad when they cancel the football. It's like Miami Dolphins.
Exactly.
Miami Tampa Bay game got moved. That's nuts. Like when was the last time that happened?
Yeah,
I don't even know. But anyway, today we have a very special guest, Dr. Liz Boyd. She is a management professor and an entrepreneur in her own consulting business.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. How are you doing, Dr. Boyd?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you here. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about your involvement with KSU and your own business?
So at KSU, I am an assistant professor in the management department. That just means I don't have tenure yet. Then I'm also research director of the Women's Leadership Center, which is a part of Coles College of Business. So I'm in charge of the research arm of the Women's Leadership Center.
Okay. Well, what kind of things are you researching?
Right. So what is that? Yeah. So I'm the research director, and then there's an executive director, and she is essentially in charge of going out and getting businesses to join and have memberships with the Women's Leadership Center, mm-hmm. and then doing programming for them, sort of like personal development, soft skills development, kind of learning more about the research on women's leadership and those sorts of things. My end of it is to try to translate the academic research into something that is actually useful for all those companies and for all the people attending the meetings.
Mm-hmm. So what would be a specific example of research that was translated?
So there was an article 2015 that talked about the fact that women don't actually have less ambition in the workplace. It's that they did an experimental study and had some managers assign women different tasks. Mm-hmm. And it was the tasks that people were assigned and the way that they were spoken to that actually predicted their motivation and their kind of like desire to get up into leadership. And so that's one of the studies. I think it was really important to bring that over into the business world, because so many people believe wrongly that women don't have as much ambition, mm-hmm. just naturally. And so trying to translate and trying to, you know, how did they do that study so they could actually show those things is what part of what I'm explaining to people. Because you can't just say, oh, well, women, you know, have as much ambition as men because this study said so. People don't believe you.
Right.
So it's a translation process.
And what are some of the things that you did different to find that out?
Well, one of the things that I do is each year I have a best of list, and I review all of the literature that's been written that year on women's leadership and gender in the workplace and that sort of thing. And then I pick, based on certain criteria, what are like the 10 or 15 best articles. And then a couple of years ago, we were allowed to give a prize. So we actually gave a prize for the best article. And what I did was to summarize the articles for people. It was almost like an annotated bibliography, if you've ever done one of those. Mm-hmm. So, you know, tell them what the article was, share the abstract, and then kind of translate it and say, this is what this article actually found. So not many people are going to know what a meta-analysis is. But what I do in the best of is I give an explanation of what the people actually did, and then I tell what the results are. So like if I say there was a meta-analysis done that showed that women and men rate themselves differently in terms of leadership effectiveness, but their subordinates don't, a lot of people don't know what that means. You know, so a meta-analysis, I have to try to explain, is a combination statistically of hundreds or potentially thousands of studies usually that shows over the course of a ton of results over years and years and years, thousands of people, that there are consistent results in a certain area. So it's kind of that sort of thing, just explaining, translating what, you know, what does a meta-analysis mean? What does a regression mean? What is an experiment?
So like layman's?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Or it's millennials, TLDR.
I know what that means.
Too long, didn't read.
Right.
Yeah. So you discussed your role with KSU and mm-hmm. but your the consulting side of things. Can you go a little bit on that?
Yeah. So I've always actually been an entrepreneur ever since I got out of high school. I owned my first business from the ages of 17 and a half to 20.
I like the half.
Yeah, I was old. I was old enough because I was 17 and a half. And then as soon as I got into grad school, I started consulting and doing like outside work on my own, contract work. So I've pretty much owned my own business from, you know, age 17 and a half and through now, which we won't share how old I am now, but it's been about 20 years.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I guess at what point, you said you started when you were 17, so 17 and a half.
Right.
But at what point did you really like consider yourself an entrepreneur? And at what point did you realize this is the path that you wanted to go down?
As soon as I started doing it, the thing that motivated me at that age was money. And the business that I actually owned was a singles dance. We don't have this sort of thing anymore because we have Match.com and Bumble and Tinder and all these other things. But people used to, back in the day, get together and dance with each other and try to pair off that way. And I loved entrepreneurship right away because I was in charge of everything. I got to make all the decisions. I got to change things if they were wrong. And in my other jobs, I also worked full-time during college, and it was really frustrating to me working for someone else that I didn't get to decide, you know, the way things were going to go. And I saw where the money was going, and it wasn't going to me. And that really frustrated me. So I really think that's when I fell in love with the concept of entrepreneurship and decided that I always wanted to have something, at least on the side, that was my own business, even if I was going to have a full-time position.
And you mentioned that when you were in college, you were doing consulting work?
I was not doing consulting work in college yet, but in grad school.
Okay, so when you were in grad school doing consulting work, was it like, what were your clients like? Was there like a specific type of client that you were helping consult? Was it someone trying to start a business, or what kind of thing was that?
A lot of people want help with kind of the HR functions. So smaller businesses, I did a lot of stuff in selection, recruiting, and training, just some of those very basic processes, because people really don't get trained in that unless you take a course like mine. You don't really get trained in how do I select somebody? If I need to hire a position, what exactly do I do? And so that's something that I think is important for people to know as entrepreneurs. And it's one of the biggest things that people call me in for.
Right.
Also, unconscious bias now is becoming really popular.
Yeah.
And I do unconscious bias research. So people are really interested in having some more training on what unconscious bias is and how we can kind of work against it.
Awesome. Is that something that you're also doing for the school, that kind of research?
Yeah, I have been in the past. Right now, we're not moving forward with anything in that area. But yes.
Okay.
I've done a little bit of stuff.
And what is the your fascination right now with unconscious bias?
Yeah, so my current fascination with unconscious bias, how many have you guys heard of unconscious bias here in the studio?
not in the studio.
Yeah, have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of you have heard of it. And
we'll pretend like we know.
So what it is, it's stereotypes. You know, it's implicit attitudes that are throughout our culture that the majority of people hold and that are communicated through things like mass media, and that then you kind of express without understanding that you're expressing them. The reason I'm really concerned about it is companies like Google, companies like Facebook are instituting unconscious bias training. That's actually, research has shown the type of unconscious bias training they're instituting is not effective. When you tell people what unconscious bias is, and you say, hey, unconscious bias is real. We all have it. We all share this thing and we need to work against it. What actually happens in people's subconscious is, oh, it's okay. Everybody has it. Mm-hmm. And research shows that people actually exhibit more unconscious bias after that because they've been made more aware of their stereotypes. The type of training that Google does says essentially, this is what unconscious bias is. Don't do it. Stop yourself from doing it. And that's what a lot of people's unconscious bias training says. And what research in social psychology says is that actually has a rebound effect. So it's sort of like telling people not to eat sweets or to go on a diet. They can do it for a little while, and then they all of a sudden just pig out. And that's kind of what people do. They pig out on stereotypes and implicit attitudes if they've been told to hold them in. So I'm really concerned, actually, because we have all these big companies, important companies in the world who are trying to help, and they're doing unconscious bias training, but the way they're doing it isn't necessarily effective. And that really, for me, is one of the main areas where research can help inform what we do.
So you're working on the alternative?
Yes. The alternative.
Sneak peeks.
Yes, I'll try to explain it kind of in a short way. So the way that stereotypes develop is repeated exposures to a pairing of, like, let's say a young African-American man gets paired repeatedly in the media with certain images, right? So those are in culture, like women are paired with certain images. Women are paired with images of, you know, being at home. If you see a commercial for Downy, it's going to be the mother, typically, where that's changing a little bit. Where was I going with that? Sorry, I got distracted by my Downy commercial. So what we have to do is actually undo all of those pairings. So there's neural connections in your mind that physically represent the stereotype. And you can pair new stimuli with that stereotyped person enough times to actually roll back the stereotype in your mind, to change the structure of those neurons and how they connect to each other. So you present pictures of stereotyped people, women, men, people of certain races, whatever, with a potentially stereotyped explanation. So he was late for work this morning. Was it because he didn't set an alarm and he's lazy, which would be the stereotyped explanation for, like, a young man, especially, you know, a young man of like a minority individual, people would associate that stereotype. So that's the negative stereotype. And then what else is provided is a reasonable explanation. So something like, the power went out and nobody's alarms went off and everybody was late for work, something like that. And so you get, you bring people into the lab, you present them with these stimuli, pair them hundreds of times. And then afterwards, you can actually see a reduction in implicit attitudes and stereotypes mm-hmm. that lasts for a little while. The research on it right now shows it lasts over 24 hours. So that's wow. better than anybody else's.
So it's kind of like a reflex.
Yes. Yeah. It's so very much implicit. And mm-hmm. you have to get to the mechanism that caused it in the first place.
Right.
Because you can't just tell yourself, I'm not going to have this unconsciously. Mm-hmm. It's impossible
now,
to do that.
With, like, say, like the aforementioned Downy commercial, you know, with the woman, she's doing laundry.
Right.
Or, you know, the dad with, you know, wearing Crocs is grilling.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. Now, y'all, like, would that butt heads with marketing?
Yeah.
And advertising. Because
yeah,
it's like,
absolutely.
I'm not saying I agree with anything they do, but they do, if it's not making the money and the advertising's not working, mm-hmm. they probably wouldn't do it.
Precisely. Yeah. A lot of advertising is based on our stereotypes. We see the people that we expect to see.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen companies try to go against those kind of norms for what you expect to see and have a man, you know, staying at home and doing laundry. And you get
Mr.
a positive
Clean.
Response. Yeah. But even a dad, you know, there was a commercial for, I think it was Tide, that had a little girl playing around in the house in her cowboy costume, and her dad had to take it off and wash it. And he was like a stay-at-home dad. And there was a lot of pushback against that ad because people were like, that's, you know, you're trying to push a liberal agenda on people by saying that dads can be stay-at-home dads. And yeah. So it's interesting. You know, they can try to change and try to be more modern, but like you said, it's always about the bottom line and what their company's trying to put out there.
And that's the hurdle. Yeah. I mean, if you get, like, just marketing in general behind it, then you're fine. But they're not going to budge if they're not going to make any more money.
No, it's not necessarily advertising's role to change society, right?
Right.
It certainly plays a role in shaping it, but unless companies are going to take that next step to say, we want to go forward and try to change these things, it's not necessarily going to happen.
And studying implicit bias must be a challenging subject to tackle, considering most people are unaware of what's happening. So right. how do you do that?
Right. It's interesting because levels of awareness are going up very quickly. People have now, a lot of people in corporate America at least, have now heard of unconscious bias, and they sort of generally know what it is. That issue really is that it's an unconscious implicit thing. And how do you convince somebody that they're biased if they outwardly believe? So, for example, I'm the research director of the Women's Leadership Center. I'm a woman, always have been. I know that I have implicit bias against women. I know that. And it's something that I work on because in my brain, I have the same stereotypes that everybody else has about, you know, women staying at home and men going to work. And I have stereotypes about men and women, and I'm willing to admit that. That, I think, is the first step, is to say, even if you are an unbiased person, that you think you're an unbiased person, you don't think that you have these biases, being willing to admit, yes, I've been subject to exposure to the same stereotypes as a lot of other people, and this is something I need to work on.
Yeah. So I guess correlation doesn't always imply causation,
right.
basically.
Right. Yes, very much so.
What would you say the best way to combat these unlearned biases? What would that be? Like, you know, you mentioned the media plays a big part in kind of establishing these biases. Should you know, we teach our kids at an early age what unbiased or what unlearned biases are, and kind of teach them how they're incorrect? Or do you think the media should really step up and kind of do their share in this as well?
Right. I think to some extent the media is changing and is doing its part. But like he said, it's only for profit at this point. It's, yeah, it's kind of a marketing campaign. I really think that, you know, what research shows is that meeting a person or multiple people, hopefully, from a group that you've stereotyped and getting to know them for real, getting to understand them, getting to see them as an individual can really help, especially at a young age, because kids, you know, are not necessarily exposed to all different types of people unless they're in a very diverse environment. So giving them exposure and get, and not just lip service, not just, oh, look, there's some people from a different culture, or, oh, look, there's this, actually interacting with people and seeing them as human beings, I think is the best way to combat this stuff. And of course, unconscious bias training that actually works.
Yeah.
So like just diversifying your friend group and that sort of
thing. Yeah, absolutely. Get out there, meet people, you know, talk to people on the internet who have different views than you or who have different backgrounds than you.
You gotta be careful on there.
Yeah. Well, you can find somebody on the internet who has different views than you very easily, but somebody understanding who wants to talk. Yeah.
Now, while you run a successful business and you're full-time at KSU, how do you balance all that?
Yeah. So I actually studied work-life balance all through grad school. My son was 3 months old when I started grad school. And so I started studying work-life balance because it was extremely relevant to me. It's tough to manage your time for sure, especially if you have a full-time position. And I know that a lot of beginning entrepreneurs are trying to do exactly that, manage a full-time position and start a business on the side. I really think that you have to know what your boss expects from you in your role, in your full-time job, and focus on doing that and not overdoing. Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs are perfectionists. They're the type of people who want to decide everything. They want to control everything. They want to make everything perfect. And I think that tendency in your regular job role can make you overdo, especially if you're trying to do something over on the side. You know, entrepreneurship, owning your own business, it's not great for work-life conflict in general. A lot of people like mompreneurs will start small businesses because they think it will actually help with work-life conflict. And the evidence shows it's a little mixed. You know, you can make it work, but it's tough. So for me, I have no idea. I didn't sleep a lot for a very long time. And I got very, very stressed. And I actually got really sick last year because I was so stressed. So it is very important to balance your time and not overdo it. I was doing too many consulting projects. I was doing too much work, and it was too much at once. So you have to keep it under control. But I don't know how.
And that's gonna be hard whenever you have to make a decision to roll back something. You're like, which side? Because there's always, it's like, do I roll back work a little, make, you know, day job a little bit? I roll back personal project.
Exactly. And I think if you were starting a business and you wanted to get out of your full-time job, that would be a little easier decision.
Oh, yeah.
You know, as the business starts taking off, you peace out on the regular job. Mm-hmm. But for me, my day job is really important to me, to staying updated in the field and staying, you know, I love interacting with college students. They always have new ideas and fresh perspectives. And I do research as part of my job. So it's a core part of even running my business, you know, to have that full-time job. So it's essential for me.
And I got to ask, what is your favorite part of the research process?
My favorite part of the research process is collecting data. It's very exciting to spend a year or 6 months or 9 months designing something and then finally have people actually going through it and getting to see the results. That's by far the most exciting part. When you download your Qualtrics spreadsheet and you go, oh my gosh, people are saying what I thought they would say. Yeah, that's definitely it.
And have you ever conducted a study where you thought it was going to go one way, but it just went completely different, and you came across something that was just, I guess, groundbreaking or something that just really stood out?
Something that has always affected me personally. I still haven't published this because it takes a long time to publish things, people. But I lived in Indianapolis for my first professor job after grad school and decided to do a study of low-wage workers because there are a lot of minimum wage or low-wage workers they're primarily female. There's like 75% female, the low-wage workers in Indianapolis. So we did a study of fast food workers. And what I anticipated was finding that they had tons of work-life conflict. I thought they were going to say, I don't have time to do anything. You know, this job is really demanding and stressful and doesn't provide enough resources so that I can't, you know, ever relax. But what they actually said was, yeah, we're kind of okay. A lot of people said, I've chosen this job. I had a desk job. I had a different job, but I like this job because there's no pressure. It's, you know, if you mess up, it's okay. And you can control your hours a little bit. But that was the one thing that people said, you know, coming into work when they weren't expected to work is like the worst thing for everybody ever, no matter what your job is. If you have to work when you weren't expected to work, that's terrible. Definitely. And in fast food, they have to do that all the time. So, but they just generally weren't super stressed out about work-life conflict like a lot of other people are. Most of the research on work-life conflict is on white-collar office workers. And, you know, they reflect relatively high levels of work-life conflict, but it was very different in the fast food sample. And I'm still not exactly sure why.
Do you think it might be like hourly versus salary?
It could potentially be. There haven't been a lot of good studies on hourly versus salaried workers in work-life conflict.
So, I mean, that would kind of make sense because it's like, you know, if you... All right, put it this way. If you don't go to work, you don't get paid. Mm-hmm. That's with hourly. With salary, I mean, you could take sick days. You have a little room there.
Yes.
So a lot of salary people have families, and it's like, you know, everyone understands. Mm-hmm. But, like, you when you're on salary... It's usually in a job to where you have a project or you have clients or something like
that. It's never ending.
And it's kind of like you have to finish it. It's not like, oh, it's 6:30, time to go home. Right. No, it's like the deal's not done.
Right. So we use this term called segmentation versus integration to talk about how overlapping people's life roles are. So people who have everything completely separate, like the you know, stereotypical guy in the 50s who went to work at the bank and then took his tie off on the way home and started drinking brandy as soon as he got home. That's high segmentation. That's like, you know, your work and your life are completely separate. And you can do that more with an hourly job. You really can. When you get into a salaried position, people start kind of thinking about their job on off hours, answering emails, obsessing, things like that, because you're always concerned about
it. You can kind of blend. Mm-hmm. You know, you could take a few minutes to like, you know, call your mom or whatever. You're like, yeah, hey, coming to visit this weekend or something like that. You know, but
it's also a lot easier to be integrated nowadays with technology and your especially smartphones. Like, you're always connected to your email. Like, beforehand, I know it was uncommon to, I guess, have your boss email you over the weekends, but now, you know, it's something that's becoming more and more common. So, you know, that might just be a technology thing too that's leading to that, I guess, higher degree of integration.
Yeah, I've done some work on smartphones, studying the role of smartphones in work-life conflict. And essentially, when people use them to bring their family and their life into work, it has really positive effects.
Really?
So if you're checking Facebook during the day, I'm cool with that. But if you use it to bring your work into your other life domains, that has negative effects on your well-being and your work-life conflict. So it's sort of like spreading work out into all the aspects of your life is not good, but sneaking you know, happy and positive other things into work is good. So
just kind of like little moments like, oh, hey, you know,
right.
I like my kids.
Right. yeah, exactly. But, say hi to grandma and then get back to the spreadsheet.
Exactly. Yeah, just like just a little micro break. Mm-hmm. Yep. But one of the thought I had about the hourly wage, it's whenever you stay late for salary, it's kind of like it's expected to get the job done. But an hourly, if you stay late, you're getting paid more.
Right.
There's more than expected.
Like an appreciation of over and above kinds of behaviors.
If you do it enough times, you're getting paid more per, you know, hour you stay.
Right.
Or 15, you know, however they work it out. But so that's kind of like a weird, it's reverse.
Yeah. One of the difficult things about salaried jobs is that a lot of people expect more what's called organizational citizenship behavior. So you have your job performance, and then over and above that, there's this thing that in IO psychology we call OCB, organizational citizenship behavior. It's people who show up early, people who bring the donuts to the meetings, people who volunteer to help other people when they need help, people who have, you know, perfect attendance records, kind of like your over and above extra go-getter type of person. The problem is those behaviors didn't used to be expected kind of in corporate America. It was like, do your job and go home. But now OCB kinds of behaviors are expected and people aren't really sure where to stop. You're not really sure where to draw the line with, you know, going over and above their typical job duties.
Right.
So that can be difficult.
Like when did that sort of start the transition? Or when was it first noticed?
Well, we didn't start studying it until the 90s. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, IO psychology, my field, is a very, very young field. We've only been around since the World Wars. And so we're not super advanced yet. We're fantastic. But, you know, we didn't start studying OCB until like the early 90s.
Well, I'd like to think it really kicked into another gear after the recession. So everyone's like, oh my God. Everyone's
absolutely
people better than me are losing their jobs. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I got to be 150%.
Yes. Yeah, and the reason I chose the field that I'm in is because there are so many options. You can do so many things. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people actually went into my field during the recession. I saw it on a lot of like best careers lists and things like that, because IO psychologists, either during a recession or after, can do a lot of things. You can get a job internally in HR. You can get a job, you know, doing training and selecting, recruiting. You can work for an external consulting agency. So mm-hmm. I think that kind of path became more popular too.
And have you compared I'm guessing it's just American corporate culture mm-hmm. and white collar. Have you compared it with any other?
Yeah, that's another big flaw in our stream of research, is that it's very U.S.-centric. Mm-hmm. And we tend to make the assumption that everyone else does things exactly how we do. But no, OCB behaviors are not necessarily going to be the same in all cultures.
So
you're
going
to be expected
that,
to do. Yeah.
The first thing I thought of was yep. Japan.
Well, it's even different in America. Women are expected to display more OCB behaviors than men. If we display less, if a man brings donuts to the meeting, people are all excited about it, right? Mm-hmm. If a woman brings donuts to the meeting, people are kind of like, yeah, she's supposed to, she's the woman. So we don't get as much credit. That's what the research shows, is that women do not get as much credit mm-hmm. and are expected to perform more organizational citizenship behaviors. So just not even cross-culturally, within our culture, we have differences. Yeah.
Hmm. So, that's one of the reasons I love psychology so much, is it is such a young mm-hmm. and blossoming right now science. And so where do you see the future of psychology going?
Yeah, more medical. I see it going more towards looking at the structures of the brain and trying to understand how those impact our thoughts and feelings and behaviors. Because right now we really focus a lot on thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. We don't really know what causes a lot of that. We've come up with these personality constructs and various things to try to explain it, but it's an inexact science when you're just asking people to report questions on surveys. So we're coming up with new methods. We have the brain lab at KSU where they look into, like, they monitor people's brain waves when they're, you know, watching various things. And so I think it's going to be really cool. Like I said, I would love to see stereotypes in somebody's brain before they go through unconscious bias training, and then look at their brain after and see that those structures have changed. That would be really cool.
Yes. Where.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You can actually see the little patterns of firing and see them change. So I think that's where we're going. IO psychology in corporate America is getting more and more recognized. People know who we are now. When I started grad school, people had no idea who IO psychologists were anywhere. And now if I introduce myself as one, people are like, oh yeah, I know what that is. It's sort of HRE, right? So.
Do you ever change up the term? Because when I mention IO mm-hmm. psychology to people, I have to explain the
yes.
entire acronym, like both sides of it, right. all that stuff. Do you ever use other terminology? Because I typically say business psychology.
Right. So my PhD is actually in organizational psychology. They changed the name of the program that I was in halfway through, and they dropped the I. They dropped the industrial. So yeah, technically it's org psychology. In the UK, they say work psychology, which I think makes a lot more sense. But
that's pretty clear too.
Yeah. Because people think that we're therapists. When I say I'm an industrial organizational psychologist or an organizational psychologist, they think I like work in an EAP, like counseling people. It's not exactly right. I think work psychologist would give people a better concept of it.
Yeah. And also, I guess another question is, you said that you started consulting while you were still getting your master's degree. Mm-hmm. And at what point did you feel confident enough that you could actually go out and give people advice and start?
Right. Yeah. That's a huge question, because it takes a while. I had a really excellent professor who had us read a book on process consulting. And I think that was really when my mind changed about how much I could help an organization. Because I think when you start out as a consultant or coming in trying to help people, you think you have to have the answer. And having done this for a long time now, I can say I've pretty much never had the answer. The answer is always either going to unfold somewhere during the process, or it's in the heads of the people there. It's just that the social dynamics of the workplace haven't allowed it to come out yet. So, you know, process consulting, when I read that book, it was all about you're guiding them through the process. You know, you're there to help them as an external kind of mediator, and you have the knowledge, but not, you don't necessarily know everything. And that really helps me, because I started, my first consulting gig was actually in a manufacturing plant in a small town in Michigan where they made sprockets.
Okay.
And I know nothing about that.
What's
but
sprocket?
A sprocket is like a gear. Like it's like a big metal I'm doing something with my hands that no one can see. But it's like, it's a big toothy kind of gear. Like they made gears for rock crushers and things like that.
Oh, okay.
So, that's interesting.
Yeah. So I knew literally nothing about it. I had to wear steel-toed boots to work. But they were a really innovative organization. They were changing into like team structure and doing all kinds of cool things. So they needed help with that. But yeah, I came in thinking I am never going to be able to answer any other questions because I don't know anything about manufacturing, but it wasn't about that. You know, it was about helping them through the process.
And manufacturing is the blue collar, totally different beast than white collar. Mm-hmm.
It's very so different. Very different.
And also when you go in to consult, I mean, you just mentioned it's not about coming in there with all the answers because you don't understand their situation. It's about figuring out what their needs are, where they're at. How much of it is how much you know and then later going and building on what you know or figuring out and researching something completely new?
Yeah. Well, luckily for me, I've been able to kind of customize the types of projects that I've been involved in. And I don't try to take on too many where it's super challenging and, you know, I don't really know what's going on. Some are more rote. You can kind of just, like, if someone needs a selection instrument, I can do that. That's, you know, I need to know what they need, but that's something that my expertise is going to have to come forward to do. If they want unconscious bias training, for example, that's something that I can just go and deliver. So it's kind of, I have different types of consulting that I do, and some of them are more involved and some of them are more kind of just off the shelf.
So what's your most, you know, you don't have to give names of the company or anything, but what's your most memorable consulting experience?
Oh my goodness. Well, I've had some really negative consulting experiences.
That's still memorable.
We'll start off with the negative and then hit us with a positive to end.
Maybe I'll go general because all of my negative consulting experiences had the same thing in common. I didn't communicate well enough to the people I was working with that they would need to be involved in the project. So each time this happened, it happened to me a couple of times, and I've learned from it, hopefully. I didn't communicate that it was their responsibility to help with the project. They needed to actually be mentally involved in it because I didn't realize that a lot of times if people call in a consultant, they kind of think you're just going to fix it. You're going to come back in 7 days with the perfect solution. Yes, wave your magic wand. And so a lot of people would get frustrated with the fact that I wasn't doing that and I was asking them so many questions and I was trying to get so much information from them and they thought that I was actually bad at my job because I wasn't just coming in and saying, here's your solution. It's perfect. So.
That's funny because there's an unlearned bias right there. They all kind of assume that you're going to go in, fix all their problems when reality is you all have to kind of work together.
Exactly. I have no idea what's going on in an organization until I talk to people. So yeah, if you just go in and implement a solution without doing that, it's not great.
Now we've talked about white collar, talked about blue collar. Mm-hmm. Now in early stage entrepreneurship, like that's sort of its own thing.
Yeah.
Now what are some major HR differences with that?
Oh, there are huge HR differences with that. So a lot of people think about like employee selection in the context of a Fortune 500 company. You know, we're going to have you go online and you're going to fill out these measures of personality and all different things. And it's going to be a very formal process. But most organizations in the United States are small businesses and they don't necessarily have access to that kind of infrastructure for selection instruments and things like that. So there are vast differences in the selection processes that people start. And, you know, as an entrepreneur for me, I don't have a staff, but I've hired people to help me in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of like a one-off selection. And it's very different from when you're trying to select, you know, 100 people for your new class of incoming attorneys or whatever. You have to focus on some of the same characteristics and really try to keep your biases out. That's the one thing that I really noticed is that when you're doing small-scale selection, like for somebody to work with you personally, bias can really come in. You know, I would have a preference toward women, for example. And I'd have to kind of catch myself on that and say, it's not necessarily that the person has to be like me. They just have to work well with me. So,
right.
And in large scale selection, you have entirely different issues. Of course, there's bias, but it's going to be more in the instruments themselves than in a single person.
I can totally see what the small scale is kind of like. It's hard to not pick like someone that you're like, oh, I could be friends with this person.
Right.
Compared to like, this person will help me, you know, accomplish my goal.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that's kind of a fun, well, they border those two thought processes.
Right. But, you know, in terms of selection processes, unstructured interviews don't predict job performance. They just don't. And that's what a lot of small businesses are still using is unstructured interviews. You know, unstructured interviews essentially asking different people different questions and not, you know, having explicit kind of a rubric that you want to go down. But people love unstructured interviews because they feel in their gut that if they can talk to someone and if they can ask the questions, they're going to be able to get to whether that person would be a good employee.
And I guess, I mean, you might be able to do someone like customer service kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. if someone's going to be working with people, like right. if he could talk with me or she could talk with me in like a normal conversation mm-hmm. without, you know,
right.
going haywire in any way, you know, maybe that would be a part of testing its own, but
mm-hmm.
that's exactly. I guess that's a very small percentage of
yes.
interviews.
Yes, it's very, and I can pretend to be nice for an interview.
Yeah.
so. Yeah. So, before we wrap up, we want to ask our last question. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing that you know now that you wish you knew when you were starting out, what would that be?
Just start.
Just start.
Just do it.
Nike.
I was so scared of starting my own business because I thought I don't have anything that I can bring to people. I don't have anything I can give to people, but you do, you know, if you want to do that and you have the passion for it, there's a lot of businesses out there. Like if you want to do consulting that can use somebody with that fresh perspective. If you want to start your own business in any other area with, you know, selling products or whatever it is, just doing it is the most important thing. Because personally, I don't know if everybody has this feeling, but to me, it's terrifying before I start something. It's always like this dread and fear that it's not going to work out. But once it starts, it's kind of okay. You can work on it then. And I think that it's really similar to entrepreneurship. You know, I've been doing this for a while now, and you can phase in and out of it. You can, you know, you can start one thing that fails and learn from it, but not starting just delays your success.
That's a great answer. That's honestly probably one of the best answers you could give, because Chris Hanks, the director of the entrepreneurship program at Kennesaw, mm-hmm. the thing he says, the hardest thing about entrepreneurship is starting.
Yes, so, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, I guess you guys are on something there.
Yeah, maybe.
Now, if for listeners want to reach out to you or learn more about like the Women's Leadership Center or psychology,
yeah,
how could they do so?
It's actually really easy. My website is drlizboyd.com, DRLIZBOYD. And my email is drlizboyd@gmail.com.
Well, there we go.
So that's very easy.
We'll tweet all those out.
Okay, perfect.
In a few minutes here. Now, I'm Adam Wozniak.
I'm Darren Parkinson. I'm
Alex Stoker.
We are Biz Radio U, pushing knowledge further by spotlighting the best in business.